Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I stayed in my workshop with my team, and we just continued to sculpt and work. And with the resources we had, we just continued to push it towards a final product.
Darren Aronofsky tells how he stayed the course making his biblical epic Noah, while the studio cut its own versions. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, David Letterman retires and the wonks prove that movies featuring women are good box office. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, Amazon is in the news a lot lately in the media world. Amazon has announced a new TV set-top box getting into a place that has been occupied by Apple TV and Roku, and to some extent Google is trying. They are going to have a set-top box. They have just picked a bunch of TV shows, I'll call them TV shows, of shows from a batch of pilots that they were testing. They have just picked them up and announced they're going to be series. And they have just swiped 24, the old Fox series from Netflix. That is now going to be all on Amazon. So they are throwing down.
Yeah, it all kind of comes together in one way. And you look at 24, 192 episodes of that show. You look at their new series, Jill Soloway's Transparent, Gary Trudeau's Alpha House, and you look at this new set-top box. The model is very clear. It's the Kindle, but it's for your TV. Amazon doesn't make a lot of money on the Kindle reader. They make their money on the books that you buy in your Kindle reader. So if Amazon can somehow shift the way you use Amazon from your computer to your TV, they will make money delivering movies, TV shows like we mentioned. And who knows, you could be watching a movie on your TV, really admire Johnny Depp's socks, and click on a button and order socks through Amazon Prime. So it's Jeff Bezos' plan to kind of make Amazon a commerce portal for entertainment and stuff all through your TV.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? They can do a version of what Google already does. It's pretty creepy, but you know, if you're emailing about, you know, that your cat has fleas, you may see a pop-up ad saying, hey, here's a flea thing for cats. And that is sort of the holy grail for advertisers, trying to specifically target advertising. And the more data they can gather by what you watch and what you buy, the better they feel they are. And Amazon is certainly going to be a very, very aggressive player in that market. But I will say, John, you know, if I stop a person on the street and say, who's sort of, you know, somewhat media interested, and ask them about Netflix shows, at least when it comes to the programming. I think most people know House of Cards is a Netflix show. They know that Orange is the New Black is a Netflix show. And I think if you ask them at this point about an Amazon show, there would be a long silence. So they have some catching up to do.
I think you're absolutely right. And ultimately, it's going to be the quality of that content that's going to decide whether or not it's successful. The advantage for Amazon is if they can create good original content, the margins, the profit it's going to make on delivering those shows into your home, it's going to be a lot higher than sending you a case of paper towels.
Turning to another area in the world of content, there is a study that was done by the biggest wonks in the world, the people at 538. You may remember, I'm sure you do, 538 used to be a New York Times feature in which Nate Silver, who is a statistics guy, was analyzing data vis-a-vis the elections, and very accurately so. And that was bought by ESPN and has recently launched as a website. And they have crunched a bunch of numbers, including on the issue of featuring women in films. And as you know, John, women are not represented well behind the camera, in front of the camera. And there's a sort of an idea that female-oriented movies are an afterthought and also ran.
Yeah, Cate Blanchett made this exact point in her Oscar acceptance speech for Blue Jasmine. And 538 went and looked back at a bunch, like hundreds upon hundreds of movies, and applied to it what is called the Bechdel test. And that is named after a cartoonist. And it's whether or not a film satisfies three criteria. one, that there's two women with names in a movie. The second is that they have a conversation with each other, and that that conversation is not about a man. And very few movies, very few, pass that test. But what this analysis by 538 showed is that those films do disproportionately better at the box office and don't always cost as much as big Hollywood blockbusters.
Yeah, some of the films that they picked out that did do well and that do pass this Bechdel test for female characters in movies include Titanic, and The Exorcist, and Jurassic Park, and Star Wars Episode One. So those are some of the biggest movies of all time. And it's heartening to know that these movies actually perform. I'm kind of surprised by some of the movies that don't make the list, such as Transformers Dark of the Moon. I had no idea.
Such a feminist film.
I did not know. And I will mention all the Harry Potters, it seems, or almost all. So maybe Hollywood will take note, because this is about money, that these are actually performing well. And there is no reason to think that movies with strong women in them don't do well.
Yeah, but there's a couple of flaws with the data. One is that a movie like Gravity, where Sandra Bullock obviously can't have a conversation with another woman, it doesn't qualify. But I think the disheartening side to your heartening remark is that in the sample of 1,794 films that they looked at from 1970 to 2013, they only found that half had at least one scene in which women talk to each other about something other than a man. So it's, I think, incredibly disappointing and disheartening that as far as Hollywood has come in many respects, it's still way behind in depicting women in a positive and accurate way.
I'm going to pivot to a man, a person who has recently surpassed Johnny Carson as the longest running late night host ever, David Letterman. As we know, the REM bassist Mike Mills broke the story, tweeting that Letterman would retire in 2015. Not a totally unexpected development, but definitely, you know, a big milestone.
Yeah, and we should make clear, Mike Mills performing on the show, and that's where Letterman broke the news. He's been on Late Night since 1982, Stupid Pet Tricks, Top 10 List, gone. And now the big question is, who's going to replace him?
And you know, as we've talked about in the past, the late night space is hotly contested. I will say NBC seems to have really pulled off a coup at this point. It seems to me Jimmy Fallon is working hard and making a lot of noise in that space. ABC put Jimmy Kimmel in the chair, and I'm just talking about the big broadcast networks now. I'm leaving aside Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, despite my love for them. This is a competitive space, and obviously, fairly or not, youth is the thing now. And Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon are young, young men, and David Letterman's been doing this a long time. So I don't know who CBS will get. That's going to be a big guessing game, but we're going to guess that the generations will be, you know, shifting.
So under that thinking, Jay Leno would not be on the short list.
I don't think so. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can find us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up, Darren Aronofsky. When Darren Aronofsky's Noah, starring Russell Crowe, opened to nearly $100 million worldwide, it almost seemed like a miracle. As you probably know by now, the film does not depict the traditional benevolent Noah taught in Sunday school, and for a time it seemed that test audiences were not responding well to Aronofsky's vision of an anguished Noah grappling with the coming apocalypse.
Our family has been chosen for a great task. To save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why are they innocent?
Because they still live as they did in the garden.
Yes. And we need to save enough of them to start again.
With a price tag of $125 million, Noah is by far the biggest budget movie that Aronofsky has ever made. Much of that money went to elaborate visual effects, not just the flood, but a large menagerie of computer-generated animals. Paramount entrusted Aronofsky with this film, in large part because of his previous success with Black Swan, which won Natalie Portman an Oscar and grossed $350 million worldwide. Paramount was hoping Noah would lure the faith-based audience, which would, in theory, be drawn to the Bible story, a general audience that might be interested in the spectacle of the flood, as well as fans of Aronofsky's previous movies, including Pi and The Wrestler. But what if the movie didn't appeal to anyone but those diehard Aronofsky fans? For a time, based on early testing, it seemed that might be the case, and that would have been a financial disaster. Eventually, Paramount became so nervous that the studio made and tested its own cuts of the film. But in the beginning,
you know, Paramount was excited. I think also, you know, finding Rob.
Rob Moore, the vice chairman of Paramount, the film studio.
It was really exciting for us because, you know, it was written by, you know, two secular Jewish guys.
Right.
And
you're actually, I've read, an atheist.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very hard term to talk about. We could go on about that for a long time. But
we won't.
It's not, you know, but... And just having Rob, who's very religious and from a different direction, was exciting.
Not only religious, but Christian religious.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So he fell for the script in a way that, I mean, we'll get to, but it does seem like you were showing him one thing and you think he was seeing something a little bit different in his head? Because
no, I don't think so. I think he saw exactly what we were doing.
Okay. So he was on board with your vision. And your vision, obviously... This is a pretty bare bones story in the Bible. So you and your writing partner, Ari Handel, were filling in great swaths of things.
I don't know, but filling in is the wrong
creating.
Word. I don't think creating is the right word either.
Tell me the right
I think,
word.
You know, there's a long tradition, you know, in Jewish tradition of Midrash, of looking at text and, you know, interpreting it, being inspired by it, applying it to your own life. And, you know, when we showed it to a group of rabbis a couple of weeks ago, we had a room full of 10 rabbis. And afterwards, they were calling it like a post-Midrash statement. And that was exciting for me and Ari, because that's how we always kind of looked at it. We really...
It's like a meditation on the story.
Sure. Yeah. And there's actually a Hebrew word we found out for filling in the gaps. You know, there's a long, long, long history, thousands of years of people looking at the text and commenting on why things are written in certain ways, why there are certain gaps in the story, because they assume that all of it is there for a reason. So if there's a gap, there must be a reason for that gap. And because the gap is there, it points at something else. So with negative space, if you want to talk artistically, in the negative space is a shape.
Significance, right.
Significance. So the dark matter actually is as important as the actual object.
So you and Rob, you showed him a script. Did you have the graphic novel at that time?
We may have. I don't think we shared that necessarily. I might have had we prepared a script when we were at Universal that had a bunch of art, religious art, as well as, you know, different types of art. So it was kind of a picture book / script that would cost us, I think it cost us like $200-$300 each to print. So it was very expensive for us. And we presented it to him kind of in a black binder to everyone at Paramount. The big part of the pitch was that we are not doing the guy with the long white beard and the robe with sandals. That's where people went immediately. You know, they went to a nursery tale story, and we had to keep reminding people that's not what's in the Bible. What's in the Bible is, don't forget, the first story after they get to land is Noah goes out and gets drunk. And to us, that pointed to a very different character than what is portrayed for kids.
This agonized character, this
or
terrible
something.
Task.
You know, he got drunk. He gets drunk that he's naked. You know, I mean,
naked
I don't know
drunk.
If that's ever happened to me. Maybe to you, Kim, but not to me.
I don't want to tell tale. No, it hasn't happened. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Darren Aronofsky. His movie, Noah, was co-financed by Paramount and New Regency, the production company run by billionaire Arnon Milchan. The producer had worked with Aronofsky on his 2006 film, The Fountain, which was not a success. But since then, Aronofsky had scored with Black Swan, and that changed the equation.
And he called me up and said, when are we going to do something again? And I said, do you want to do something crazy? And he was like, of course, I'm Arnon. And he came to Paris where I was, I think, promoting Black Swan and, you know, sat in a cafe and went through that binder and read every page. And I would go off and get a falafel and then come back and he'd still be sitting there.
Because that's
he was
what you
reading
have in Paris is falafel. Right?
Great falafel in Paris. And he just read it, and then he said, okay, let's do this. And so I had Arnon before I went to the town.
50%,
Arnon was the first.
50%.
Yeah, yeah. He was like, let's find a partner.
Obviously, Hollywood has been chasing a Passion of the Christ, that kind of success. Was there any discussion about this is also a third rail potentially, or any awareness on their part, on your part, of the potential that there's this audience
right.
that might be problematic or difficult?
I talked about it, and I said I was under the impression that the Noah story was so ancient that it wasn't really historical. You know, the Jesus story is in recent history. Even the Moses story is a historical document about, you know, a slave uprising. But the Noah story is so fantastical. When you actually look at what is described in that pre-Diluvian world, there's the talk of angels walking on the planet, and everything's a miracle. There's the fountains of the deep exploding. The people are living for centuries. So I didn't think there would be an issue with literalism, because it felt so magical and fantastical that I thought people would obviously be excited by the idea of interpreting it that way.
And then there's the other side of the issue, which is the budget. And the budget is by far the biggest budget you've ever worked with.
But very small for these big movies.
Yes, certainly these big movies can come in at 2, 3. Right. But I read this in this New Yorker article about you, that your friend David Blaine, the magician, said, "Don't take that much money from anyone, then it won't be yours anymore."
Yeah.
Did you think he was warning you?
He's got a lot of knowledge. He's been around, you know, he's been in a lot of big situations. I guess I haven't. I don't know. I mean, I thought we had a good, I felt that when I was talking to Rob and I was talking to Arnon, that everyone kind of was just excited about this, what we were making. And I understood that it was a collaboration, but it always is. I mean, when I made a $60,000 movie, I was dealing with my investors who gave me $15,000 about cuts and about decisions and choices. And there was long, long discussions about how things should play out. So I don't think it changes that much. I think it's just more people involved and more people with a lot more experience involved.
So you weren't daunted, like $100 million, woo.
I knew it had to be big because, I mean, when you do Noah's Ark, there's all those miracles, and we knew we had to make a visual spectacle. We had to, you know, represent the animal kingdom. We had to represent the Nephilim. We had to do the great deluge. At that point, we didn't know how big it was or what it was, but I needed the experience of a studio that does this a lot, and also the experience of a studio to sell it properly. So that's how you'd make these films.
Going in, you know, you all are clasping hands and sharing a vision. Was there ever a conversation saying, by the way, I don't like to test my movies? Did they say, by the way, we always test $100 million
right.
movies?
I don't really remember, but I imagine it was assumed we were going to test. I mean,
by you? Because I understood that you were not really.
Look, you know, I think there is some value to testing. There's definitely value to testing, you know, a comedy and a horror film, you know, to really see a response of it. Even though, you know, we did a little testing of Black Swan, and it did not get the same reaction as the finished film. You know, I didn't get any scares when it was, you know, in its kind of unfinished form. So I think things change when things get polished and they get that kind of pizzazz to them. People just get into it more. You know, that's that final sheen of magic that is on a movie that you can try to play around with and sort of get a sense of it, but it's very hard. And when you're dealing with something that's basically a drama and an action film, it's very hard to take a pulse on what the audience is saying, especially when you're dealing with something that has tremendous expectations of what something is.
When we return, Darren Aronofsky explains how he coped as Paramount tested half a dozen of its own cuts of Noah. That's next on The Business from KCRW.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Darren Aronofsky, whose film Noah is in theaters now. When a studio spends $125 million to make a film, and tens of millions more to market it, the usual practice is to test the picture while it's still a work in progress. Aronofsky resisted, believing that audiences could not be expected to respond well to an unfinished film with only rudimentary visual effects. Paramount tested the movie anyway, and the results weren't good. Audiences didn't care for Russell Crowe's unhappy Noah, and there were ominous rumblings from segments of the Christian audience that felt the film wasn't true to the Bible story. So Paramount cut and tested various alternative versions of the movie, including one that began with a montage of religious imagery and ended with a Christian rock song. In the end, none of the studio's cuts scored better with the test audiences than Aronofsky's. So the Noah in the theaters reflects the director's vision. I asked Aronofsky what he was doing as Paramount cut his film.
I stayed in my workshop with my team, and we just continued to sculpt and work. And with the resources we had, we just continued to push it towards a final product.
I mean, did you go to the first test screening and decide this is ridiculous? Or did you just say, I'm not going to a test screening? How did you deal with it?
I just could tell by the first reactions that...
At a test screening?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I could tell by the first reaction that there wasn't much we were getting out of it. You know, there were completely unfinished scenes that an assistant editor who was on the job was like, he thought the scenes were done. And this was an editor. This was a professional who was looking at it and wasn't really sure if he was looking at finished work or not.
And to you, it was clearly far from finished.
Oh, yeah. It had miles to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think... You know, it pulls you right out. Even me, if I go see an unfinished film, an unfinished shot, you're not thinking about the movie anymore. You're thinking about the shot and how they're going to finish it. As a filmmaker, you're
thinking
about
it. So what the people are going to see is like film, and then some sort of...
Cartoon. Basically, that's going to cut to a cartoon. And I remember when we first got the trailer, you know, they sent me an early cut of the trailer, and it had, you know, these pre-vis shots in it, which are basically sophisticated cartoons. And I was excited by it. I was like, oh, this is cool. And I remember showing it to someone going, oh, isn't this cool? And they kind of looked at me with this kind of look of, you know, nervousness. And they were like, oh, that looks like a cartoon. They didn't get
right.
That.
They couldn't see what you were seeing.
They didn't understand that there was a leap there, that's going to actually get better and become photoreal. And that's, you know, they can't be expected to because they haven't been through the process.
So you say, like, they say to you, let's test it now. And you're like, yeah, let's not.
Look, at a certain point, I mean, I was always interested to see, you know, look, you can always learn from something. And I tried to be open. But, you know, I believe that it probably wasn't the best way to work with my process. I think trying every sort of mashup didn't really make sense for what we filmed. And if you were watching the footage of what we filmed, it was very specific. You know, Russell is very specific in what he does. It's not like you get three different versions from Russell, you know, and you can play a scene in different ways. He spends a lot of time figuring out what a scene is about, and he commits to a decision. And when you're, you know, working with him as a director, you can maybe get a little bit of, you know, other shades. But the thing about Russell is everything he does is right and specific. And if you start moving those scenes around, it doesn't matter. It's not there.
It's not
in the material. And that was the nature of the material. I mean, I've worked with actors where you can get do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. You
right.
get every try level
it.
Of every scale.
Funny,
and they love
you
it. You know,
scary.
Ellen Burstyn is like, oh, sure, I'll try that. Boom, mm-hmm. bomb, bomb. But, you know, RC is like in that sweet spot of what he thinks the scene is. And that's great because... You know, the magic of Russell is that he can do the tiniest thing in his face and there's every person in every language understands exactly what he's doing and can feel it.
So these, you were doing your thing and they were doing their thing. What if, can we play what if? What if one of their versions had tested better than yours?
I got no idea.
What would you do?
I have no idea.
I mean, did you ever say the words, I'll take my name off?
Oh, no. We never, there was nowhere, you know, I mean, you know, that's not, it, we don't want to play that game, you know. It's about, I really have no idea. And believe me, I was scared because I, you know, believed in my version of the film. And I knew that it would come together when we got everything together. And luckily, you know, in the end, Paramount and Regency gave me the resources to finish the film properly.
They backed you in the
absolutely
end.
And they backed me with all the effects I needed and all the music I needed. I mean, I'm sure I could have used even more. You always want to polish, but I mean, for what they gave me, I made the film that we set out at the beginning to make. Absolutely.
And they put a lot of marketing, it seems, like tremendous.
Well, I think they believe in the film now. You know, they're really excited by it. And
how did you feel about the 3D version overseas idea? This is them deciding that they will do this movie in 3D overseas only, because I guess that's very appealing to a lot of foreign audiences.
I mean, it's a distribution thing. I really was not that involved in it. It was late in the game, and, you know, they brought on a great, great team to do it. And I think the final product is...
Did you watch it in 3D?
I haven't actually seen the final thing. But for me, you know, I wouldn't say this represents my work in 3D. It's just basically...
You want to do 3D?
A conversion. I'd be open to it. I mean, when I saw Avatar, I was really wowed by, you know, that bead of sweat in that opening shot, or one of the few opening scenes. It was like, wow, okay, there's something exciting here. So... And I think, you know, it changes the visual medium.
So at this point, I mean, the movie hasn't opened as we're sitting here. How do you feel about the commercial performance of it? Because I read somewhere where you said, I take full responsibility. And I thought, well, that's fine. But
right.
These people are on the hook.
Well, I meant, when I was saying full responsibility, I was for the creative decisions of the film is what I meant. You know, it's not my fault if it doesn't do well. No, I'm just kidding. I hope it does well. I mean, it's so beyond my control, really. It's just the thing about making movies, and the most important thing, I think, is first to make a great entertainment, because, you know, the worst thing you can do is bore an audience. So if you get that done, and hopefully we have, then the next thing you want to do is, when you make a film like Noah, is make a visual spectacle and make, you know, have people just see things they haven't seen before. And then the third thing, which is the most, you know, which is really important, I think, is that people leave the theater talking about it, that there's a conversation. Because for me, you know, I can't stand when I leave a movie and 15 minutes later, you're like, what did we see again? You know, I like the ones that really get you. And I hope that this film does that people talk about it. So for me, going out there and talking to people about it and... It just raises a lot of conversation, because it's a hot topic, religion and the story of Noah and the environment.
And you even toss in a little evolution just to mess with their heads, I think. I don't know. It's like, I mean, there's a definite allusion to evolution, which you are making as a thing that could coexist with a biblical story.
Well, of course it can, because the biblical... It's not just a biblical story, the Noah story, you know. It's a biblical story, but it's also mythical. If you look at the Noah story in the early Genesis parts as poetic, it can be more powerful and more inspiring. It's kind of like, you know, the story of Icarus. You don't really ask about the feathers and the wax and is that possible? But the message of it, that if you fly too high, you're going to get burnt, the hubris, is such a great message. And it becomes more powerful when you don't fight over the history from the sense of if it really happened, or, you know, the non-believer side that, well, all the animals couldn't fit on the ark. That's the wrong conversation. The conversation is about that the ideas in this movie are about having a second chance to take care of creation, a second chance not to be wicked, a second chance not to bring violence to the earth. And we're living that second chance right now. And when you look at the story through that lens, it becomes a powerful experience.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Will Bentley. You can listen to us on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and hear the podcast on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. Also, be sure to check out our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.